From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we meet some kids who can sing. And not just anything. Opera.
Our crystal diamonds like a heart, warming us with magic power, beauty and love.
Little voices with big heart. Then we learn how music can strengthen more than just our vocal cords.
We predict that singing in a choral group, we will see improvements on measures of cognition.
And we hear how a local conga drummer unexpectedly finds answers to lifelong questions.
I said, "That's my father, but I haven't seen him in 30 years. She said, "Well, he has a Berkeley address."
We're reunited today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. School has been in session for a couple of weeks now in districts around the Bay Area, but one class that won't be taught much is drama. The U.S. Department of Education says only 4% of elementary schools provide any kind of instruction in theater arts. A decade ago, that number was 20%. But there's an after-school program in San Francisco that's introducing students to the performance stage, a place where they can create and perform an original opera. The youngest kid in this class is 6, and no one is older than 11. KLW's David Boyer takes us behind the scenes of the third season of this unique children's theater company.
Take it away.
Zoom!
Zoom!
Whoa!
Whoa!
A dozen kids are vocalizing, gathered in a circle in an elementary school classroom. Tiny chairs and tables are all around, and craft projects and the letters of the alphabet line the walls. It's a diverse group that includes African-American, Caucasian, Latino, and Asian-American kids. It's early in the Little Opera season, but they already have an intricate warm-up down pat.
Mamma mia!
Mamma mia, want some pizza?
Mamma mia, want some pizza?
Over the next 8 months, Little Opera will meet twice a week at West Portal Elementary in San Francisco. But this is not about doing a kiddie version of Carmen or Rigoletto. It's about kids creating their own operas. And unlike most children's theater companies, where the kids are actors and the adults call the shots, these kids have the final word on every artistic decision, from storyline to music composition to how short a sleeve should be on the queen's costume. That is exactly how the company's founder, Erin Bregman, imagined it.
I had this idea sort of percolating for a long time of creating a children's theater company where everything was made by kids.
So in 2011, she founded Little Opera. The idea of children working in an art form typically associated with gray-haired socialites is intriguing, but it seems like a hard sell, not to mention a musical disconnect for kids raised on Glee and Frozen.
On the first day of Little Opera, the first thing we ask is what is opera? Depending on if they've had any exposure to opera before, you get everything from, we already know that it's some theater on stage where everything is music and a lot of people die, to, is it Oprah? But one of the things that I always do on the first day of any class is I show the Bugs Bunny cartoon, What's Opera Doc?
Be very quiet, I'm hunting rabbits.
It quotes a lot of Wagner music, and so there's one part that the kids always end up singing later that's Kill the Wabbit,
kill the Wabbit, kill the Wabbit.
Kill the Wabbit?
And after we show that to kids, there's really no conversation after that at all of opera not being something that is theirs.
Okay, it's one thing to understand the concept of opera, but writing one? Where do you start? Especially with kids as young as 6. How about with where the opera is set?
Maybe it could be in the water.
That's what I was thinking, Halloween with a pumpkin house.
The choices this year are, they vary dramatically.
That's Claire Shaw. She's Little Opera's managing director and music specialist.
They had a fun fair, they had Antarctica, they had random things like jungle, and they had all these different places.
They even toyed with setting an opera inside someone's big toe. But after a vote by secret ballot, they settle on
Crystal Castle in Antarctica.
Along the way, the kids will make many more big decisions about their opera, but it's still a delicate balance as they work with teachers and visiting artists. Little Opera wants to make sure that the kids are in the driver's seat. But they also want the opera to make sense and clock in significantly shorter than Wagner's 15-hour Ring cycle.
One of the biggest questions that teaching artists have is, like, how much do I, not necessarily dominate, but steer where this goes? You're guiding them. You're guiding them to a good story.
Now the really hard work begins. The kids brainstorm a list of characters and begin fleshing out the story.
What always ends up happening without fail is that some of the characters become really interesting really fast, and the whole opera story gets built off of them. It takes a while to get to the story because I keep asking them more questions. But in the end, they have a really rich, complex story.
That's an understatement. Here's the story the younger kids came up with.
The opera, well, it's about this royal family, and they live in this crystal castle in Antarctica. And there's a villain who's trying to steal the crystal diamond.
And he saw the crystal, but that one was fake. So when the kookaburra flies down, the villain puts a spell on him and he says, "You are under my command, you work for me now." And then
because they have written the story, because they know the characters, once they get to the lyrics and the composition, they generally know how they want it to sound. They might not know the exact notes, but they really have a clear idea of what's the shape of this musically in a really broad sense, and then our job is focusing that and getting it specific.
Zeke, I need your attention now. It's really important. So
getting children to focus, period, is not an easy job. 4 months into the season, teacher Suzanne Verdelis works with an antsy group of kids on the libretto, the opera's lyrics.
What makes a home?
I know.
Yes. What?
Love.
I miss my royal family's love. Yeah, would we want to repeat love? I miss my royal family's love. Their love, their love.
Yes.
Okay, then the other thing we're missing from our libretto is we don't have anything about the crystal diamond. Why is the crystal diamond so important? Yeah, I see your hand.
It gets warmer and warmer because of love.
Wow, that's sort of a very poetic thought.
And that's what happens. Sometimes it comes together and the kids say something profound and poetic, or they just conjure up the perfect rhythm.
Happy there.
I'm happy there.
The pieces are beginning to take shape. Now Little Opera invites professional musicians to come play the works in progress and give the kids a chance to adjust their compositions. Friction Quartet worked with the older kids, ages 9 to 11. After the quartet plays, the kids offer feedback.
More forceful.
Oh, we can make it forceful.
More forceful.
You could all try plucking the strings.
Visiting cellist Doug Matches says if he'd had an experience like Little Opera when he was a kid, it would have changed his musical life dramatically. He began playing piano at age 6.
Well, I think my experience with piano was a little bit bland and intense because I studied with a Russian teacher. He was very serious and wanted me to memorize pieces and learn all the notes, and I think this would have brought much more lighthearted and fun angle on music, and it would have really stimulated my imagination and what music can mean.
Ultimately, founder Aaron Bregman thinks Little Opera is nurturing a new generation of musical makers and creators.
I think with Little Opera, we're fostering kids who aren't afraid to make things and aren't afraid to dive into things that they're not experts in and to create, which I think is very much part of the whole entrepreneurial spirit of the Bay Area right now.
But it's about more than making. It's also about putting on a show.
It's a performing art, so the piece isn't finished until it's performed in front of an audience.
9 months after they first met back in September, it's almost time. Sets and costumes are built to the specifications of the kids. They've moved from the elementary school classrooms to the elegant curtain stage of the Missions Community Music Center. And backstage, during the final dress rehearsal, the energy is frenetic.
I'm excited to perform!
Me too! I'm scared.
Sometimes when I was little, I used to, I was performing and I was so nervous, I just ran off at the stage and started panicking.
How do you make sure that you enjoy it?
I just let it go.
Birthday girl, birthday
the end, a total of 250 people came to see two sold-out shows. Family and friends were treated to performances full of energy and passion, including a synchronized drumming routine and an intricate shadow puppet scene. Sure, a few kids missed their entrances, but all in all, it was a huge success. For founder Erin Bregman, the real sign that Little Opera is working is that the kids are already talking about next year.
I wanted to be different next year because I didn't agree to have the Crystal Castle. I agreed to have a pumpkin house.
Now we can finally take this off.
For Cross Currents, I'm David Boyer.
Registration for the new season of Little Opera ends on September 12th. This year, the program's open to kids in 2nd through the 7th grade. For details, go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now from young singers to more mature voices. One thing that's considered a staple of getting older is memory loss. But our memory decline isn't necessarily inevitable. In 2012, a study at UC Berkeley found that older adults who kept their minds active with memory games were less likely to develop brain deposits that lead to Alzheimer's disease. Now at UCSF, another study is being conducted, this one involving singing. The Community of Voices Choir at UCSF measured the health of seniors who sing in local choirs every week. The only requirements to participate, be over the age of 60 and agree to be tested for memory, balance, coordination, and mental well-being. What they're hoping to discover? That singing is great medicine. KALW's Angela Johnston brings us the story from our archives.
Oh, my Lord.
Miguel Garcia has tears in his eyes while he's singing. This song brings back memories. He's wearing a red Manchester United jersey, navy blue track pants, and bright green flip-flops. Garcia is 61 years old. He says that his past was at times, well, unhealthy.
This is my escape, you know. I was in alcohol and drugs about 20 years, but I'm clean 10 years. Thanks God I'm living now. But my escape is the music, you know.
But today, Garcia isn't singing just for pleasure. He's actually part of an ongoing experiment that's testing his mental health through song. Garcia is performing in a choir at the Western Addition Senior Center. It's part of a larger network of choral groups that are being studied to determine how singing with others affects the mental and physical health of seniors. Julian Johnson is a cognitive neuroscientist who's leading the study at UC San Francisco.
We predict that singing in a choral group compared to a randomized control group, we will see improvements or less decline on measures of cognition, lower body function, and also the psychosocial aspects that we're looking at.
The idea that exercising your mind using music isn't new. There's actually a part of the brain called the motor center that responds to rhythmic cues and goes into a sort of autopilot mode when responding to music, especially when it's music we're familiar with. But Johnson believes something different happens when seniors sing in a group.
A publication in 2006 found that older adults who sang in the choir for a year had fewer falls, they had fewer over-the-counter medications, their morale was higher, and there was a hint that their depressive symptoms were less than the control group.
The Community of Voices study goes further, pinpointing exactly why there were fewer falls and testing how singing affects cognitive memory. Over the next 4 years, Johnson and her team will observe 12 choirs in diverse San Francisco neighborhoods. Seniors who have never sung in choirs before will practice everything from gospel to cumbia. Researchers will gather data on whether memorizing music and interacting with peers actually has an effect on healthy aging.
This is really meant to be a learning experience so that they're using their memory and their mind and really having to learn and listen to new music rather than just singing tunes that they already know for 20, 30, 50 years.
At another senior center in a neighborhood called Merced Heights, Marjorie Wong is getting assessed by Johnson's team of researchers before she's assigned to a choir. Wong is 75 years old. Wong describes herself as healthy, but not so active.
Since I've retired, I've become sort of like a couch potato because I love my PBS Mysteries and Masterpiece Theater.
During the first part of the assessment, a researcher records Wong's ability to remember words a computer is telling her.
I want you to listen carefully because when the computer stops talking, I want you to repeat back as many words as you can remember.
So when you're learning new pieces of music, you're using a lot of different cognitive or thinking skills. You have to pay attention to that melody and the rhythm. You have to also listen for the words. And the process of rehearsing that over and over is the learning process.
She explains that learning music is like coordinating a symphony in your brain between parts like the cerebellum and frontal cortex. As that symphony gets better, your mind becomes stronger and more alert. Across town at the Centro de Latino Community Center in the Mission, another choir is learning a Oaxacan love song. Martha Martinez is 66 years old. She says she enjoys learning new songs, and she tells me she loves feeling like she is a part of something.
Ay, para mí es algo especial. Yo siempre soñé.
She says singing is special for her. It's something she feels with her heart.
Para mí, a pesar de mis 66 años, yo siento que con el canto revivo.
It revives her, she says. And that's exactly why Julene Johnson thinks this study is so important.
You have the same number of people that are singing together. You oftentimes, you know, make new friends. You make new connections with people. I think that process of having a goal and working on something together that's aesthetically beautiful in a group is really, there's something unique about that.
Ultimately, the study wants to promote singing as a way for seniors to feel included in their communities, regardless of the health benefits.
And I would love to see a recommendation for staying involved in the creative arts throughout life.
There are more than 40 million people in the United States over the age of 65, and that number is projected to double by the year 2040. So if this study is successful, it could mean that the prescription for improving your mental health may just be to learn a song. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
The Community of Voices study is a joint project between UCSF, the San Francisco Department of Aging, and the San Francisco Community Music Center. Find more information at klw.org and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we turn from singing to drumming. Carolyn Brandy started playing the conga in the late 1960s.
It was something that women didn't exactly do in those days. You didn't grow up and think, I'm going to become a conga drummer. But I became really mesmerized by the congas and by Afro-Cuban music.
Ever since she was a young girl, Brandy has also been mesmerized by a mysterious dream. Here's the story from our project, Hear, Hear.
Enuaye mi baba. Oh.
I had a recurring dream. And in my dream, I was being chased. And I was being chased by a man on a horse, on a horseback. And I would look over my shoulder and I'd see him coming after me. And it was a soldier on horseback. And there was two places that I had this dream. One was I was a young girl running through a dry riverbed bank, and I was scrambling up the sides of the riverbed. And then in another dream, I was on a flat like a plane, and I was running like running for my life. And this man and the horse were coming after me faster and faster.
I knew her first in a dream. I'm running up the sides of a dry riverbed.
My father was in the service. He was an army man, and he was a mixed race man, and he married my mother, who was a socialite from San Francisco, and they got married during the war, 1946, and had me. My father was always in and out of the house because he went to Korea. He was a special forces guy. Well, him and my mother never really got along very well, and one day he disappeared. I didn't know till later that he had been deployed to another place. He became like this big taboo subject in our household, and she never ever talked about him again. And we were never ever told any information about him after that day. I was like 9 years old. I told all my friends all the way through fourth grade through college that he was on maneuvers. He'd be back any day. I lied. In 1986, I got a phone call. I was living in Berkeley, and the operator on the other end of the line, she had already called like three times. So one day she called, and I answered the phone, and she said, "Is G. Brandy there?" I said, "George Brandy?" She said, "Yes." I said, "That's my father, but I haven't seen him in 30 years. She said, "Well, he has a Berkeley address." She said it was illegal for her to give me the address, but since she had found her own father only 10 years before that, she would give it to me. I was petrified. I called my best friend and said, told her what had happened. She said, "Let's go over there." I said, "When do you want to go?" She said, "Let's go right now." So we went up to the house, knocked on the door, and this little old man came to the door, nothing like the man in my fantasy. And my friend said, "George Brandy?" And he said, "Yeah." He was kind of a crusty old dude, you know. I said, "George W. Brandy?" He said, "Yeah. Who's asking?" And I said, "Well, I'm looking for my father." And he stared at me, and he said, "Carolyn?" He said, "Yep." He started beating his chest. "Yep. You found me. You found me. It's me. It's me. You found me. You found me, all right." And he took me into the house, and there were baby pictures of me all over the house. His house was 8 blocks from mine. It changed my whole life. I was 40 years old, and I didn't have a very strong identity. My mother would never tell me anything about that side of the family. And as it turned out, they were Cherokee, and they had been marched from North Carolina into Oklahoma during the Trail of Tears. People died on the trail. It was the middle of winter, and they left them there in the snow. There were 7,000 people. Only 2,000 people made it. My great-great-grandmother was running away, and she had been chased by a man on horseback, a Lieutenant Harrington, and he grabbed her and took her, and he took her into Texas where he raised her with his own family. When my father told me the story about that, I knew immediately that the little girl in my reoccurring dream was my great-great-grandmother. I think the last time I had the dream, I was probably in my 30s. Every now and then I would have that, and I would remember, oh, yeah, I've had this dream a lot. You ever have that? You know, I believe that we all have destinies and that we come here, you know, with a destiny that we live out. And so this definitely was part of my destiny. I had 7 years with my father, and he passed. I was with him when he died. And me and my best friend, we sang him into the next world and drummed for him.
Eluaye mi baba, Eluaye mi moseo, Eluaye mi baba.
That story was produced by Nina Gensler Debs.
O batala da wini wini shekure.
And And that does it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Leela Day, Sandhya Dirks, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Holly J. McDee, Daniel Moore, Ted Muldoon, Rachel Vasquez, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio, and we love to hear from you. So email us at news@kalw.org and find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. This is Bay Area blues band Crosscut. You can find them performing at this year's Union Square Live concert series in San Francisco. That's tomorrow night. Show starts at 6 o'clock, and it's free. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.